many, many interesting hashkafic ideas, halachic points, and philosophical concepts and divrei Torah that connect to this aliyah. Certainly can't do them all justice in whatever time we have, but we'll try to see what we can touch upon. And then essentially, just to give an overview, that this aliyah contains everything from the decision to marry Rachel and to work for her, and then the switch, that it's not Rachel who ends up with Yaakov at first, but it's Leah, and Yaakov's anger at being duped that way, and then the agreement to continue on and to marry Rachel as well, all the way to the birth of several of Leah's children. So all of that is contained in this aliyah. It's quite a bit, so we'll see how much of it we can discuss. So just from the very beginning, so we see that Yaakov used to work for 7 years. In general, Yaakov's behavior as an employee is held up in the Rambam and elsewhere, and the Gemara, based on Pesukim, as a little bit emblematic, or to a strong degree emblematic, of the responsibilities of a poel, of a worker on behalf of someone else. And this is a little bit of a synergy chazara opportunity. So those of you who were with us last year will remember that we spoke about the halachas of poelim last year towards the end of the year at some length. And a poel is different than a koblin. A koblin takes on a specific task and works on it on his own schedule, and is paid by the task, while a poel is paid by the hour. And the risk, the concern that the Gemara seems to have based on Pesukim, is that a poel, even though he's getting paid, but the fact that he sells his time is dangerously close to an eved. And we have the notion of ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, says the Pasuk in Parshas Behar, v'lo avadim li avadim, that we are not meant to be avadim of any human being. And there are halachic concerns which are expressed from the area of a poel, that a poel, even though he's being paid, we don't want him to cross over the line from being a poel to being an eved, and there are risks about that. We saw at length last year the sugya in the first parak of Bavitzia, and later on in Bavitzia, of poel yochel achzer b'chatzi hayom, that a poel has to have the right to pull out, because otherwise he comes too close to being an eved. And there is a halacha, which some accepted, some didn't, but some of the Rishonim have. It's also based on Pesukim, that there's a 3-year maximum, that one should not contract himself out for more than 3 years, because he will cross the line into avdus by doing so. So clearly, as you can imagine, there's a lot of discussion about that. What type of contracting are we talking about? Are we only talking about a poel who's working all day in the boss's house, doesn't go home at night? What type of commitment are we talking about? You know, clearly nowadays people are very often signing contracts of more than 3 years. Do we assume that that's different than what the Rishonim discussed, because you sleep in your own house, you have vacation time? There's a lot of discussion about whether or not this 3-year limit exists and what exactly are its implications in the modern context of work. But in any event, so here Yaakov is committing himself to a 7-year schedule of work, and there are those who complain that this seems to be against the Mordechai, who was one of the Rishonim who insisted that there is this 3-year limit. So there's discussion about this in the Sefer Paris Yosef. Paris Yosef is a very beautiful Sefer on Chumash, where he collects from all over the place, and gives the halachic discussions and the stories and the agadic discussions, and a lot of interesting things written about 100 years ago. And he only has Amoreshus Shmos and Vayikra. So until Vayikra, we quote from the Paras Yosef. From Bamidbar and Dvarim, there's a very, very prolific Talmud Chacham who's alive today, by David Mandelbaum, who writes a tremendous amount. So he came out with Svarim in the same style, called the Paras Yosef HaChadosh. So when talking about Bamidbar and Dvarim, we might be quoting from the Paras Yosef HaChadosh, but in Bereishis we have the original Paras Yosef. So the Paras Yosef discusses this question, and he assumes that maybe this is a raya, that there is a heter for the sake of getting married. That in general, there is a whole discussion that if we say that it's prohibited for one to sell himself into avdus, at the same time we have an institution of eved ivri in the Torah. There is such a concept of being an eved, while at the same time we say that it's wrong, ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim. So it seems to be, as the way some of the Rishonim understood, some of the Sfarim understood the halacha,
circumstances, that if a person has no other way to support himself, he's going to collapse, otherwise he simply can't feed himself. So then it's necessary for him to do what he can to survive. So then he'll enter into an arrangement which may otherwise be strongly discouraged by the Torah. So it's possible that that's what's going on here as well, that if you're allowed to do that to support yourself, maybe getting married is as important, and Yaakov decided this is the only way he's ever going to get the shidduch that he needs to continue Klal Yisrael, so he could take upon a commitment that we would otherwise frown upon in order to do that. Similarly, to the Kal Vachomer that comes from the other direction, he points out also, so here he's saying that getting married is as important as making a living, and we also find, for example, in the halachos of selling a Sefer Torah, that one is allowed to sell a Sefer Torah, which we normally also frown upon, in order to provide... someone who wouldn't otherwise be able to get married. So we find that emphasized as something in halacha that would allow us to do things we otherwise discourage. So maybe that's what's going on here. That really this is not an ideal arrangement for him to get into. And again, is this really comparable to any workers that we have nowadays who sleep in their own houses and who have vacation time and who have lunch breaks and the like? It's itself a question, but it's likely that Yaakov's working conditions were much closer to that which the Mordechai was talking about, in order to say that you shouldn't enter into such a circumstance for a more than 3-year commitment, and therefore maybe it's justified, or it's clearly justified by something. It was justified because this is what he needed in order to get married, and therefore that's as important as a basic parnasa, and therefore it's justified as kind of a less than ideal type of agreement. So then just to move on for a moment, so the Pasuk Tu Psukim later talks about an idea which many find difficult. It says it seems to be counterintuitive that the time that Yaakov was working on behalf of Rachel, so the Pasuk says, V'hayu k'yamim achadim, that because he loved her so much, it seemed like it was only a few days. And it's hard to relate to that type of imagery because we normally think the other way around, that if we're very anxious for something to happen, so then it feels like it's a long time. It doesn't feel like it's shorter. Time goes by more slowly when we're anxious to get to the other side. So what does it mean when the Torah says that because he loved her so much, the time he had to wait for her felt like it was only a few days? That sounds like the opposite of what we would have said. So that's a good question. There are a lot of comments on it. The Sefer Tam Vidas, Moshe Sternbach on the Chumash, so he has a suggestion which I think there's a lot to learn from, that he was assuming that the Torah is telling us here that Yaakov's interest in Rachel was a spiritual interest. It wasn't just that he was very anxious to marry her for other reasons, but that he recognized that this is the next step in what will be his spiritual growth. And therefore, he perceived the time between now and then is a time of preparation, is a time also of working on himself so that he'll be ready for that. So if that's the case, so then when you see that the time in between here and where you want to be is necessary for you to develop properly, so then the time becomes much more scarce. It feels like it's going by too fast. And the Havasu saw that he loved her so much and realized what he could gain from being married to her spiritually, so the time that he had to prepare himself began to feel like it was very short. I've mentioned this to people in general. Sometimes, for example, the time that we spend in college, which for many of us is also the time that we have in yeshiva, so we recognize that it's important, but we also sometimes feel like it weighs down on us and we're counting the minutes, especially when you're younger, right? You're counting the minutes for the school year to end. It seems like it's dragging on. So sometimes noted that I think a good piece of advice from many directions is that if one feels like you can't wait for school to end, so the more you recognize that what's happening in your years in school and your years in yeshiva is necessary for the rest of your life, so then you start to realize that the time becomes very precious and that it's going by too quickly. And it's worthwhile for one to set goals for himself during his time in yeshiva, during his time in college, that maybe are a little bit too high, not so that you become frustrated, but so that you come to cherish and recognize the value of the time. You don't want graduation to come so quickly because you recognize that all this time that you're here is time that you need in order to seize the opportunity to grow, and that both helps you enjoy the moment a little bit more and also maybe set a little bit of a higher goal for yourself and hopefully attain that goal. And I think that's an important mindset to take on. So anyway, so he does all his work, and he ends up thinking that he's marrying Rachel, and the Torah tells us that, turns out that it was really Leah, that Leah apparently had participated in something somewhat deceptive, and had fooled him into marrying her. So there is clearly a major question. The Rishonim dealt with, the later Svarim dealt with, that it's not clear why this should be effective. That we normally assume, so if you learn Hilchos Nisuin, so we talk about the halachas of marriage, so we have Edim, and we have all types of steps where it's clear that it's imperative that the witnesses and the Chasam HaKala, that they confirm who they're dealing with. So we know that if somebody is going to marry somebody without intent to marry them, it's not really possible for that marriage to be valid. So how could you say that Yaakov's marriage to Leah took effect? It would seem to be a mekach tos. So somebody, if you go to your wedding, nowadays, if you go to your wedding, you think you're marrying one person, it turns out the person was wearing a disguise, and right afterwards they pull off the rubber mask to somebody else, so then that's not a real kedusha, that's a mekach tos, you don't really have a marriage. So how is it that Yaakov was married to Rachel? So there are a couple of approaches. The Rishonim already asked this question, and the Rishonim said, we've all quotes from Rabbeinu Tam who asked this question. So some of them have an approach that clearly Yaakov knew this was a possibility. Right? That was what he said to Lavan, Rachel Bitcha Ketana, that he was very specific in who he wanted to marry, because he was aware that there might be an issue here. He was aware that something might happen. So this was not a total surprise to him. So some Rishonim assume that since he didn't want to be involved in a Bilas Nus, he didn't want to have a relationship, physical relationship outside of marriage, so therefore he had intent that whoever it was, he wanted to marry them. If it was Rachel, preferably he'd be marrying Rachel, but if it was Leah, then he'd be marrying Leah as well. Moshe Sternbuch in his Sefer, Tam Vadas, a little bit of a different spin on that, and he says that the idea is that when he saw that Leah had the simanim, a little bit of a question what the simanim were, but maybe they are some indication of moral worthiness, perhaps. It's a little bit of discussion what they actually were, but when he saw that Leah was able to establish her status, so he caught on that she was Leah, but he thought that the existence of the simanim was enough reason to marry her, and so he did knowingly. And his complaint to Lavan, when he says Lama Rimisani, doesn't mean that you fooled me, it means that you acted to me in a deceptive fashion. So why did you do that? Why did you treat me this way? And that's what the Torah says when it seems to indicate that Yaakov did love Rachel, but he did love Leah, but he loved Rachel more, that he did knowingly marry her, but he was still upset that Lavan had used this method to try to fool him. So in one sefer that maybe the simanim that were given over, you know, it's a famous brain teaser, they ask the kids, what would you do if you have a country where half the people are liars and half the people tell the truth all the time, and one person says, I'm a liar, so what do you do? If he's lying, then he means he's a truth teller. How do you figure out exactly how to assess that? So there was one sefer that suggested that among the simanim, you should say, is that he told Rachel that if I ask you who you are, you should say you're Leah, because he'll assume that Leah was coached in order to, if Leah would be there as under false pretenses, she'd be coached to say she was Rachel. So therefore he told Rachel to identify herself as Leah. So then Leah could honestly identify herself as Leah, and it would still exist as the Siman, and it would still confuse him. Okay, whatever it is, but in any event, so it seems to be that it wasn't a mekach tos, even though there was some type of deception that was taking place here. And when he asks Lavan, he says, Lama Rimisani? So, as the Maharitz, Rabbi Yosef Zvi Tushinsky comments in a Sefer, and others ask, what do you mean, Lama Rimisani? As another famous story goes, that's what I do. He's I'm a rabbi. Lavan is, you know, he was a dishonest person. So, what was Yaakov saying to him when he said, how come you treated me in such a manipulative fashion? So, there are those who suggest what the Maharitz writes is that Yaakov was also protecting himself against Lavan's deception, and he didn't want to tip his own hand, that he was afraid that if he showed that he was so much more interested in Rachel than he was in Leah, so then now Lavan would jack up the price against Yaakov, that he would say, okay, so you worked 7 years L'maisa for Leah, so now work another 14 years for Rachel. So but what Yaakov was basically conveying, which seemed to have an element of truth, is that he did love Leah also, so that was fine. And then maybe he was even conveying here in a little bit of an exaggerated fashion that he was even more interested in Leah than he was in Rachel. So he's saying, Lama Risani, why did you have to fool me? I would have married Leah happily. You didn't have to pull the shtick. And now I'm happy to marry Rachel also, so I'll do the same 7 years. But you shouldn't get the impression that you have to make it a higher number because I'm equally interested in Leah. So that's fine. You shouldn't think that you have some leverage over me. That it's going to be a higher price. Hi.
What was Laban's interest in doing this whole shtick? He just wanted to spite Yaakov, just give him a hard time for 7 years.
Well, he gets more out of him. It's not spite. He gets, it's not some that he's hurting him. He gets benefit. Yeah. That basically, and the Mefarshim discuss this at some length. You know, he's a manipulator. Basically, you push for the most you can get. So, to whatever extent, you can squeeze a certain amount out, and then you can change your language, or you can squeeze out more. So, then that's the kind of behavior he engaged in. He also managed to get both of his daughters married off, which is a big goal as well. So, he accomplished a lot. He's on the winning side of every equation here. He gets Yaakov as two son in laws, and he gets, all these years of work for him. That's a pretty good deal. But there are some broader hashkafic issues here that the question is often asked. So it's not just Laban who deceived Yaakov here. It's clearly Leah was complicit completely. And obviously that does raise certain questions, but it also evokes the whole episode in Parshas Toldos with Yaakov himself. And that's what the Medrash suggests, that Leah, there are different versions of this, they're shown, we quote the Medrash and the Bereishis Rabbah, that Leah essentially said back to Yaakov, what tiny do you have on me? I did the same thing to you that you did to your own father. And the Medrash has a whole long discussion about how Yaakov called out for Leah in the middle of the night, and she answered in such a way that implied that she was Rachel, and then when Yaakov was indignant, when he had moral opposition to that, so she said, I seem to remember that there's somebody who his father called out to him and asked him what his name, and he said he was a sibling. He said he was Esav. You know, clearly, why should this surprise you so much? So this is a difficult concept for us to really know how to totally approach, but on the one hand, we have to be very, very careful in terms of assessing the behavior of our holy ancestors. But here, the Medrash, in drawing a comparison, so we see at least as much, and clearly there's a lot of basis to say this, that however we understand it, that Leah's behavior is meant to be understood in a way that's comparable to Yaakov's behavior. So whatever attitude we take towards one, we can take towards the other. There are those who suggest that it reflects some type of failing in Yaakov's behavior, whether it was his control or not. Clearly Yaakov had to do what he did. He was instructed by his mother, whose mother was also a Neviah. She was also a prophetess, and the assumption is that there was actually a chiyuv of listening to a Navi in Yaakov's going along with the plan that Rivka had. But it could be there's still what to address. So for example, Rav Rivlin, the Mashgiach in Karen Biavna, in his Sefer on Chumash, so he discusses how when somebody has to do what we call an Aveira Lashma, you have to do something which would otherwise be wrong, but it's necessary for a higher goal. So sometimes that still needs a kapara, that still needs a fix. And he compares it to, I'll take a question in a second, he compares it to, for example, if somebody has to take a medicine to save his life. But he knows that the medicine has a side effect, which is also going to have to then fix with a different medicine. So he's still going to take that medicine because he has to save his life, and then he's going to have to deal with it with a side effect. Like the Gemara says, he makes this reference also, like the Gemara says about fasting on Shabbos, if there's a tiny chalom, if somebody needs for whatever urgent reason to fast on Shabbos, so the Gemara says, okay, so he'll fast on Shabbos, which is a disrespect to the laws of Shabbos, and later on he'll have to be Yoshev Tanis the Tanis, he'll have to fast again to do tshuva for fasting on Shabbos. So this was a necessary act that Yaakov did, but it still needed to be addressed. It still leaves an impact on the soul. And therefore, he needed to be at the receiving end of this treatment, that was all a part of the process, so that he should understand what it feels like, and that he should have that type of kapar. I mean, clearly Leah's behavior, besides looking at this medrash, but it clearly does fit very neatly into a comparison to Yaakov's on so many levels, including the goal, right? That the Chazal tell us that Leah felt that otherwise she would be married off to Esav, and she wouldn't be in her rightful place in terms of the legacy of Klal Yisrael, which is very similar to Yaakov's motives himself in terms of replacing Esav. So it's not just the methodology, but the goal, the ultimate justification, is very similar. So we can see how they could be aligned with each other. So the approach that Rav Rivlin is emphasizing is saying that there needs to be some type of a kapara for the Avera Lishma. He also makes a reference to a comment that a Tziv makes in his Sefer in the Herchav Davar, in the more extensive part of the commentary on the Chumash. Earlier in Parak Chav Ches, the Tziv says, he quotes a medrash to this effect also, that when you have a mitzvah, so we don't care so much about your motives. You do the mitzvah, so if you happen to have side hana from the mitzvah, that's fine. But we have an aveira lishma, so then you can't benefit at all from the aveira because it's only allowed for the sake of the mitzvah. So he quotes a medrash that suggests that when Yaakov took the bracha from Esav, so there were two people who were upset. There was Yaakov, there was Esav who was upset, and there was Yitzchak who was upset because it was not against what he had thought he was going to do. So there was Agmas Nefesh to both of them. So Yaakov certainly felt bad about Yitzchak's Agmas Nefesh and certainly understood that as a lamentable, necessary consequence of what was happening. But Esav's upsetness, he didn't feel so bad about. He felt a little bit self-satisfied about that. That's just what the Nesiv quotes from the Medrash. And therefore, he says this also needs a kapara, so he has to be on the receiving end of this treatment. And one could say that without criticizing Leah at all, because again, she certainly seems to have the same justification that Yaakov himself did in terms of the behavior, in terms of the behavior that she was engaged in. So it's a very serious topic, but there is a lot to be said about considering how the two go together and the two are motivated by very similar goals. Hi.
I feel like our unique school, we made that like the instance with Yaakov is more justifiable than play, because like you have, first of all, he was instructed by like,
right. That's a big part of the equation. It's true. Right?
Yeah. So that is like a somewhat different. But in addition to that, you would say that for Yaakov, it was more than just wanting to be a part of like the continuity of the Jewish people, but it was really a question of like the existence of the Jewish people to begin with. Because had it been made with had Baruch Hu been given to Esav, and you know, there you can make the argument that it wouldn't have necessarily come to fruition or whatever. But with Leah, it's like if it wasn't Leah, there would have been like Rachel. There still would have been like a continuation, but it wasn't so much the same question as with Yaakov. It was more.
You could be right. It's hard to know any of those elements in any of the hypotheticals, but it seems to be that just writ large, that the motivation of Yaakov, in addition to the fact that he was commanded to by the Nevi'ah and by his mother, but the motivation of Yaakov was the recognition that he had to be playing that role in the future history of the Jewish people. And Leah similarly felt that she had to be playing the role she played, and not being Mrs. Esau, she had to be married to Yaakov and raising his kids. And on that level, abstract in that way, is highly comparable, even if there may be some differences in degree. So when Yaakov complains to Laban, he says, "Why did you fool me?" So Laban says, "Well, what do you want us to do? Le'asa came bim komenu." That the idea that the younger sibling is going to get married before the older sibling, we don't allow that. That's not our minhag here. So therefore, of course, you're going to have to marry the older one first. So Rav Sternbach asks in his sefer that clearly Laban knew this. He knew that she was the older child. So what did he think when he originally made the deal that he was going to marry off Rachel first? So then what was the claim then? So he thought that maybe his defense would be that, oh, at first I thought that, okay, so Leah is the oldest, so she should marry Esav. He's the oldest. And then I found out afterwards about this whole event with the birthright that Yaakov ended up being the before. So then I realized later that Yaakov should really be marrying Leah. So maybe that was his defense. That was his excuse. But it's interesting. So this idea of Loyasa came from Komenu, so this seems to be Laban asserting a certain ideal, and it's not the only time that's Aliyah. We'll talk about it more in a second. So the question becomes, do we also respect that ideal? Is this a machlokas between Lavan and Yaakov, in which case presumably we would paskin like Yaakov? Is it that Lavan thought you always have to marry the older sibling off first, and Yaakov wasn't worried about that? So then presumably if it's a machlokas Yaakov and Lavan, so then we should presumably prefer Yaakov. There are those who read this exchange as saying that Lavan was trying to talk in Yaakov's language. and saying, you probably care about this, so therefore I'm telling you that this is our ideal. Others say he was making a dig at Yaakov. He was saying, again, in your culture, you switch the Bechura, you switch the older one for the younger one. By us, we don't do that. In Komeinu, we don't do that. In your place, we do that. But is this at all a halachic value? So it's an interesting question. The Tosus and Kedushin, and Afnin Bezim and Aleph, Dibra Maschav Hilchasa, that there it sounds like Tosus quotes this line from Laban as if this is a halachic ideal. The whole discussion that Rishon had about trying to figure out a father married off one of his two daughters, was it the older one or the younger one? And Tosfos invokes this as if this is a principle that we subscribe to, that we would always, at least l'chachila, try to marry off the older children before the younger children. So this was a major discussion in Poskim, if this is really such an ideal. The Tshuvas Avnei Chayfetz. I often quote Rabbi Aaron Levine, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, my teacher. This was a different Rabbi Aaron Levine, who was the grandfather of the Rabbi Aaron Levine, who I make more frequent reference to. Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, who taught here, was a grandson of Rabbi Aaron Levine, who was known as the Reish Rav. He was a member of the Polish Parliament, actually, and a very big Talmud Chacham. And his other grandson spoke here last night, not referring to Justice Scalia, but on the panel with him was Nat Lewin. Nat Lewin, who was a first cousin of Rabbi Levine's, and Rabbi Shechter's, actually. So he's also a grandson of the Reish Rav. They're both grandsons of Rav Aaron Levine, the original Rav Aaron Levine, who has a sefer on Chumash, which is now we're referring to now. It's called Hadrash V'Ha'iyun. But he also has tshuvas, and his tshuvas Avnei Chayfetz. So he has a tshuva where he asserts that it's forbidden for a younger sibling to get married before the older sibling. He says this based on the concept of the obligation of kavod, that there is an obligation of kavod towards an older brother. At least what it sounds like from the Gemara Ksuvos on Daf Kuf Gimel, there's an obligation of kavod to an oldest brother. And it's a machlokas for Shonim. Does that mean only the oldest brother or older brothers? It's a whole sugya we could talk about someday. And does it mean only brothers? Does it mean also sisters? So many Rishonim assume that it's not just about the Bechor, the oldest brother, but it's about older siblings, brothers or sisters. And in that context, the Avnei Chayfetz says that it's wrong for a younger sibling to get married before an older sibling, because it's a violation of kavod. The kavod that one has for an older sibling means that they're not allowed to do this. He says it's possible they have machila, the older sibling could be machil, but other than that, it's a problem. And a lot of other poskim didn't accept this. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about this in Tshuva Sigris Moshe, and Avner Ezer and Chelik Bezis and Manalev, where he assumes that this is not the case. He says, to whatever extent the poskim had such a concern, it means that you have all the siblings already engaged, they already have their shidduchim arranged, so then whose wedding should happen first? Okay, so then you should take care, they're all ready to get married, you should take care of the older children first. But if it's a question of the younger sibling putting his life on hold, not getting married because of the older sibling hasn't got married yet, so Moshe thought for sure that that's not the right thing to do. Even though the Avnei Chayfetz said that if one were to do that, even though he's doing mevakel a mitzvah, he's not getting married, he's not doing peruvu, so he says it's like his onus b'takanas chachamim, that he's an onus, essentially, he doesn't have a choice because he has to conform to the halacha of respecting the older sibling. So Moshe Feinstein didn't accept this, and it seems to be that the majority view among poskim is not to accept this concern. But it is an interesting discussion, and it's interesting that Tosfos, as we mentioned in Kedushin, has this as a value, which wouldn't necessarily mean, in the context of Tosfos, it wouldn't necessarily mean that it's incumbent upon a younger sibling to delay his life if the older sibling hasn't gotten married. There, the Tosfos was talking about, if we're trying to figure out which sibling a parent tried to marry off, which one's more likely, so then all things being equal, he would have tried to marry off the oldest daughter first. So even if Tosfos is quoting Lavan as a halachic value, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an overwhelming imperative. This was somewhat of a machlokas haposkim, and it seems to be that the common understanding is like Rav Moshe, that that's not a fair or even recommended burden to put on a younger sibling, but it was an interesting discussion as to what exactly it means and what exactly it covers. There's also possibly another halacha that was discussed here in the Kardas Yosef. He notes that he could ask the question that he says, Leosa came to Komeinu, we don't do this here, it's not the minig. So, okay, it's not the minig, but you knew, like the question mentioned before, you knew it wasn't the minig, and you made a deal. You made a deal that you're going to marry your younger daughter off first. So shouldn't that deal be binding, even if it's against the local minig? So it happens to be, it's a machlokas. The Shach says that tanai, you make a condition, is not effective in dinei mamonos to override a local minig. And the Smad disagreed. So the Paris Yosef has a comment, and maybe this is about that machlokas that essentially Lavan was saying, that who cares what I said, the minig overrides it, because if it's not done here, then it doesn't make a difference that I said something else. And Yaakov was saying, like the Smad, that no, that your Tanai should be definitive, even if there is a minig that would otherwise indicate in a different direction. But then there's another halacha, and the next pasuk says another halacha that's connected to Lavan. So whether or not we are talmidim of Lavan from this previous idea about not marrying off younger siblings before older siblings, so the Talmud Yerushalmi quotes a din from the next pasuk. That the next pasuk, people sometimes think that what happened here is that Yaakov worked seven years to marry Rachel and ended up with Leah. So then he had to wait another 7 years in order to marry Rachel. So that's not what happened. He had to commit himself to working another 7 years, but he married Rachel immediately afterwards. But not immediately, because Lavan says to him, Mali Shulazos, that you should work, wait for another week, and then marry Rachel. You don't have to wait the whole 7 years, but wait another week. So why do you have to wait a week? Question about that?
Yeah, isn't Pashas the plus like in Shavua is you should fill out your Shavua, like the values that you're going to work for?
I think it means wait the week, and that's what he did. He waited a week. So the question is, why did he wait a week? Why didn't he either wait 7 years or wait a day? So the Yerushalmi says it's because of the Sheva Brachas, that you can't have two overlapping. If you marry two women, it's halacha, it's brought in the Rambam. If somebody marries two women at the same time, he can't have Sheva Brachas of one at the same time as the other. You have to have two separate Sheva Brachases. Because Eim Arvin Simcha V'Simcha, we don't let one Simcha impinge on the others. That's a familiar halacha from the Bavli, the Gemara, Maseches Mo'ikadon, learns it out from other psukim. Most well-known from the Chanukah Sabayis of Shlomo, or the way we seem to assume, that the Pasuk says, V'samachta B'chagecha V'lo B'ishtacha. So the Gemara says, Eim Nosim Nashim Moed, one does not get married on Yontif, because of the prohibition of Eim Arvin Simcha V'Simcha, that you can't dilute the Simchas Yontif with the Simcha of getting married. So it's a whole discussion how exactly that plays out. It seems to be at least the way the Bavli represented it, which is more clear. It's a drasha on the pasuk to samachta b'chagecha. So we assume that that's a din daraisa, a Torah prohibition to get married on Yontif, which therefore leaves you with a counterintuitive conclusion that it's a bigger avera to get married on Chol Hamoed than it is on Shabbos. That when there's a chi of simcha, like on Yontif, including Chol Hamoed, so to get married then would be a violation of this Issur D'oraisa of Eim Arvin Simcha B'Simcha. And on Shabbos, it's an Issur D'Rabbanan, and we tend to assume that there is no chi of simcha on Shabbos, so it's not a contradiction to the simcha to get married. It's a D'Rabbanan that's related to the Issur of Kenyan and the Issur of Kosev. It's probably an Issur D'Rabbanan to get married on Shabbos, so it's not the way you would normally think. But if you had a choice, you had to either get married on Shabbos or on Chol Hamoed Sukkos, it's less of an aveira to get married on Shabbos than on Chol Hamoed Sukkos, because it seems like this is a real drasha in HaTorah. But in Yerushalmi, they learned it out from this pasuk, and there's a lot to discuss about why this pasuk versus that pasuk. Don't have the time to go into a full discussion of Ein Marvin Simcha B'Simcha. Maybe we'll find some way to connect it to Hanukkah or something. We'll find some way to bring it in a little bit more. But it's a big discussion. They also point out that why should you have to wait a week for the Sheva Brachos? Because the Gemara, which says you can't get married on Yontif, so it makes it clear, though, that you can get married on Erev Yontif. So you can have your Sheva Brachos overlap into Yontif. So why don't we say that's the same problem? Why do we say that you have to have two completely separated Sheva Brachos for 7 days and then 7 days? If you got married the day before Yontif, that's acceptable, and then there'll be an overlap into Yontif. And there the Gemara makes it sound like just one day is enough. You have to have at least Maker and then one day of Simcha for the wedding. So if you have that one day before, so then the rest can overlap into Yontif. So why shouldn't you say the same thing when it comes to Sheva Brachos? So before we should talk about this, and they suggest that it's really a different issue, that even if you connect it in the broader sense, that we don't want to dilute one Simcha with the other. So okay, so there's one type of dilution when the wedding and Yontif overlap. But if you're married to two women, and the two women have to share Erev Shabbat brachas, so that's really going to cause problems in the household, and that's really, in a serious sense, it's really going to make each wife feel that she's being shortchanged, and that her celebration is being diluted, and that's a more serious issue than having Shabbat brachas overlap with Yantif, so we can more easily accommodate, just push it up one day in advance to not come at the same time as Yantif. But when it comes to two Shabbat brachas, it comes to two wives, that's going to be a more serious dilution, and there they have to be completely separated and they can't overlap at all. Others suggest, from Nasa Gishtetner has discussion about this in the Sefer on Chumash, actually, in his Lovers Nashon on Chumash, that maybe the concern is really more about how your marriage will hurt Yontif than the other way around. That in general, people, halachic requirements aside, or maybe they're consistent with this, but somebody is more excited about his wedding than he is about Yantif. So if the wedding is going to be on Yantif, that's going to really overwhelm the Yantif, and you're not going to be able to properly address the Yantif. But to have the wedding pushed up a day, okay, so then everything will have its own place. But when it comes to two weddings, two Shabbat brachas, you don't have the same type of equation, and therefore they have to be completely separated from each other. So there is a lot to discuss about this. Again, maybe we'll find time in the future to be able to go into the sugya of Eim Arav and Simcha B'Simcha. But either way, if we follow the Yerushalmi, so then we've just possibly, depending on what side you take on these things, we've possibly just learned two lessons from our Rebbe Lavan, which is a little bit surprising. Right? One would think that Lavan is not the person to emulate in terms of halachic values. So why is it that we're following him now, possibly in two different halachic matters, in two consecutive psukim? So that's an interesting question. It's discussed in the exact same way by two different svarim. So one we mentioned before, the Sefer Paras Yosef. So the Paras Yosef, in the original version, the Hakdama to the Paras Yosef, so it's a fascinating Hakdama. He has a, it rhymes, the whole thing is written in a rhyming couplets. So a lot of fun to read. So he has a Dvar Torah in the introduction to that Sefer Paras Yosef, which is the same Dvar Torah that the Torah Tamima writes. Torah Tamima doesn't write it here, and Chumash, he writes it in one of his other Sfarim. He has a Sefer on Chumash that's called Baruch Shamar. So in the Baruch Shamar, in the beginning, so he talks about Matovu. The beginning of the Siddur, he talks about Matovu. So who taught us Matovu Halacha Yaakov? Bilam, right? So again, we're quoting our Rebbe Lavan here, we're quoting our Rebbe Bilam there. Doesn't seem right. How is it that we're looking up to such people and quoting them for halachic purposes, quoting them as part of our tefillah? How could that be? So in his commentary to Matovu, so the Baruch Shamar, the author of the Torah Tamima, he has a whole discussion about all the times that we do this, about Eim Arav and Simcha B'Simcha, and all the times that we quote people who don't seem to be such role models, and we quote them for halachic purposes. So he says a vort, he has the stira there, and again the Paras Yosef has the exact same vort, in a different place. He says that there's a stira, which is not the kind of stira that would keep you up at night. It's the kind of question you only ask if you have an answer. It's not the kind of question that would bother you. But the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos that Ezehu Chacham Halo made me kol adam. Right? Who is wise? Somebody who learns from everyone. So it's a stira, it's a contradiction, because the Gemara in Talmud says Ezehu Chacham Haroes Hanolad. A wise person is Roes Hanolad. We normally translate that to mean that a person who has enough foresight to be able to realize how things are going to turn out, he can look into the future and he can see what will happen, that's a Chacham, Haroes Hanolad. Which one is it? So is it a Roes Hanolad or a Halom Ibn Kolado? So I think you probably could say they're both Chachamim, but okay, so let's assume for a second it's a stira. So the Paras Yosef and the Torah Tamima, they both say the same answer. They say they were mistranslating Haroes Hanolad. That really the Chachma, the clue of Chachma is that somebody is not overly burdened by who it is who's saying something, but he's able to be Makabalas Emes Mimisha Amra, that if somebody says something that is actually wise, is actually true, and you can consider it independently, and you can realize that it is true and it is worthwhile, so then a Chacham is able to perceive that, is able to be Lomed Mikol Adam. So he says that's also what the Gemara then means. It says Haroes Hanolad, translated differently, it means that as opposed to looking at the Molid, when you have an idea, you don't focus so much on the Molid, on the one who created the, who gave birth to the idea, but instead you look at the Nolad, you look at that which was born, you look at that which was created, and you say, is this a worthy idea? Maybe I have to be a little bit skeptical because who said it, but I'll consider it, I'll look at it, see if it's worthwhile or not. So that's the sign of Chachmas. So they say it both means the same thing, that Halomed Mikolada means Yeroes Hanolad, as opposed to the Molid, you look at the product instead of the one who created it, and you wonder, is it worthwhile? And that's enough. So that's what the Baruch Shemar says in his comments on the Matovu. And the author of the Paradis Yosef, his name is Rav Yosef Patsanovsky, in his introduction to his Paradis Yosef, he writes, maybe you don't like me so much, maybe you don't think I'm so impressive, but hopefully I have some worthwhile ideas in the Sefer. And he gives this whole Dvar Torah to say that even if you're not such a fan of mine, hopefully you'll be Roas Hanola, not the Moglid, and you'll hopefully like my Sefer. It's a worthwhile read. It's a lot of the rhymes. You should take a look at the introduction to the, I think, the older version of the Paradis Yosef. If they're available on HebrewBooks.org, take a look. It's all available online. Okay, so fine. So then the next pasuk, so he actually gets married. The pasuk says Va'yitein lo bito li'isha. So here, of course, you have the famous question, also a halachic question. That so this is obviously something we're aware of, not just from this pasuk, it's our whole history. But Yaakov married two sisters, which we assume the halacha is an erva. I assume that that's prohibited. So how could it be that Yaakov was able to marry two sisters? It's an extensive discussion. Nowadays, that would certainly be prohibited for a Jewish person to do. That's a question, how it could be that he could marry two sisters. So the Ramban discusses it. The Ramban has a couple of theories. One theory he has is that the notion that we have that the Avos kept the whole Torah before it was given, that that was only true in Eretz Yisrael. And when they're outside of Eretz Yisrael, they didn't necessarily keep it. And that may be connected, possibly, to why the Hashgava had it that Rachel died on the road. She didn't make it back into Eretz Yisrael, so that Yaakov would not be able to be married to two sisters in Eretz Yisrael. But there's another approach, which I think is interesting. We could take it a little bit further in terms of understanding the whole idea of the Avos keeping the mitzvos, which itself is a whole difficult idea to understand. Based on a pasuk in Parshas Toldos. At the end of the first Aliyah in Parshas Toldos, the Gemara has a drasha that the Avos kept all the Torah before it was given. So here you could ask, so then what's Pshat? How did he marry two sisters? So the Ramban says that the reason for the prohibition of marrying two sisters is because, as Chazal say often, they use the word for a co-wife. Someone's married to two wives. So what's that called in halacha? A tzara, right? It's called a source of anguish, that the assumption is that the wives compete with each other, and it creates a difficult circumstance, which seems to be also why throughout Jewish history, even before Echerim de Beinu Gershom, it was never very widespread that Talmid Chacham and the like would be married to more than one woman. So if that's the case, so perhaps when we have two sisters, we're all the more concerned of the sibling rivalry and the like, that it's especially a dangerous combination. One should be married to two sisters at once. But Yaakov saw that here, you see the relationship between the two of them, that Rachel gave Leah the simanim. She helped her sister do this plan to marry Yaakov instead of her. So clearly there's such a loving relationship between the two of them that these two sisters are mutter to marry. That even if it's a general prohibition to marry two sisters, these two sisters, it was okay. So that's what the Ramban seems to indicate. And I think just to explain that a little bit more, why it sheds a little bit of light on the whole idea of the Avos keeping the Torah, that normally we say, Lahalacha, we say, Ein Dorshin Time at the Kra. It's a Machlokas in the Gemara, it's a Sanhedrin and elsewhere, that if somebody thinks he knows what a mitzvah is about, you know what the reason of the mitzvah is, we're encouraged to try to figure out the reason of the mitzvahs as part of Talmud Torah and as part of the Musar value. But if we try to apply halachic ramifications, we say, okay, the mitzvah means this. So it doesn't apply to me here because it's not relevant in my circumstance. So we assume that that's not permissible. We say, Ein Dorshin Time at the Kra. We don't have the reason. We don't have the ability to apply our reasoning, even if it's very compelling reasoning, we don't have the ability to apply our reasoning to how we fulfill mitzvot in the Torah, or how we apply mitzvot in the Torah. So you could say, all right, so what about that? Shouldn't Yaakov feel that, okay, ain't Darshan time at the Kura, so who cares if there's an exception to be made here conceptually, but you don't apply your reasoning to the mitzvot? So the problem is, there's no reason to apply, it would seem, Ein Dorshin Time B'Dekra as a rule to the Avos, because the idea that the Avos kept the whole Torah before it was given, that seems to mean, the way many understand it, is they weren't commanded in the Torah, so therefore it means that they figured out the svaras of all the dinim in the Torah, and they decided to follow all the Torah because of the logic behind it. So it would follow that for the Avos, if the logic didn't apply in a given case, they wouldn't feel compelled to observe it. That even if we, as mitzuvim, if the Torah gives us a mitzvah, we don't have the right to say, well, the logic doesn't apply, we won't observe it. But the Avos were observing the mitzvahs because of the logic. So if the logic didn't apply in a specific case, presumably they did have the right to be Darish time in the krah, of the future krah. And therefore, they should have the right to make a different decision. So that seems to perhaps be what was going on here. Yaakov decided it's permissible for him to marry two wives. So the pasuk goes on. Hi, two sisters. I mean to say, yeah.
Why specifically for like polygamy? Why is it even a discussion about whether or not it's not like specifically on the Torah that like you're not allowed to have more than one wife. It was made later.
No, with two sisters. Two sisters.
Oh.
Yeah. If you can have two wives, you can't marry two sisters. So that would be a prohibition. So apparently, you're right, the logic of two wives applied to any two wives. But it seems to be that this idea of a tsar is especially relevant when you have siblings. The concern is much greater of what will happen in terms of the tsaras. So Yaakov was able to say that, okay, for these two siblings, it's not true. Perhaps that's the idea. The pasuk also says, "V'yahav gam es Rachel mileah." So he loved Leah. He loved Rachel apparently more than Leah, but it also does sound like he did love Leah, as we mentioned before. It's not that he didn't love Leah at all. So many of the Mephoreshim note that there are psukim that sounds like she was hated. It says Snua, that she was not loved. So it's not such a hard question to answer. I had the opportunity over the summer to hear some lectures from the Talmud Chacham and Tinek, who's a professor Subin, who focused a lot on what words mean in the Torah and in later usage. And he pointed out a whole pattern there about how in the Torah's usage, often the words ahuva and snua and things like that don't really mean loved and hated. It means one is preferred and one is less preferred. So here, Leah was loved, but Rachel was loved more. It doesn't mean she was actually hated. It's hard to imagine that Yaakov would hate one of his wives and marry one of his wives. That's something that would itself be a very difficult concept. But it's also relevant to understand that besides just the general translation possibly meaning preferred and less preferred, that there is a different standard when it comes to one's wife. We know the Gemara in the beginning of the second parak of Kiddushin, the Gemara says that it's not recommended that one get married to a shliach. Rather, it's important that the husband should meet the wife first, see the wife first, because otherwise maybe it'll be something that he doesn't like, and it'll be a problem if you have to lerecha kamocha. So it's clear from that Gemara that the phrase, you have to lerecha kamocha, the mitzvah in the Torah, you have to lerecha kamocha, is being applied on a whole different level. Right? No one says that the mitzvah, which seems to apply to all the other Jewish people in the world at least, that, oh, if you see one flaw, you're going to hate them. You're going to violate, you have to lerecha kamocha. It's clear that there's a different standard. So the standard that one has of appreciation and love towards one's wife is different. And so when we talk about Abba and Sinner, we're talking about different things. But also Rav Schwab notes in a Sefer on Chumash that perhaps what's being indicated here is that vis-a-vis the marital relationship, as far as one's wife is concerned, that if one prefers anybody else over his wife, so that's called Sinner. That's something that takes away from the proper relationship that a person should have towards a spouse. And even if a person ends up having two spouses, so then they're set up for such a problem, but that the usage of the word snu is not in the sense that we say, well, sifsas achicha b'levecha, it's not the avera of sinna. It means that there is something fundamentally lacking, that a spouse is due one's maximal amount of love, and if one prefers anybody else, so then that is an offense to that spouse, even though by any other person it wouldn't be an offense and it wouldn't be a violation of losisna sachicha b'levecha. So then it's interesting, you know, we have this idea that if a person has the Yisurin in this world, so sometimes the Yisurin are a kapara, and the person is therefore able to have other things work out better because they went through these Yisurin. So it seems to be there's an explicit source for this in this Aliyah, in this next Pasuk, because the language of the Pasuk is, Vayar Hashem ki snua Leah vayiftach es Rachma, that God saw that Leah was less preferred, or whatever we want to translate the word snua, and he opened up her womb, so she started having children. So the implication is that even though she seems to be very fertile, very able to have a lot of children, but it wasn't so simple, that she actually had the status of an Akara, and in Chazal, she's listed among the Akaros. We know we talk about Rivka and Rachel as in Chana about the Akaros. You find that Leah, who had so many children, it seems so easily, is listed among the Akaros. So Chazal understand that really, theoretically, that was her destiny, that she could have been an Akara, but as a consequence of the fact that she was a Snua, so Kadosh Baruch Hu blessed her with children. So on one level, it sounds like this is a direct Torah source for this concept that a person goes through Yisurin in this world. She goes through the unpleasant experience of being the less preferred wife, so that balances out with some other situation being fixed when it otherwise wouldn't, and now she's able to have children even though she had been destined for infertility. The Ramban, this commentary, makes it a little bit more direct, that also because she was less preferred by Yaakov, so therefore she needed to start having the children that would give her this edge, so there's a direct correlation between one and the other, but again, it still seems to have this idea that there's a balancing out in Shemayim when a person has afflictions, he's served in this world, that may replace other types of suffering, and it may end up that this is ultimately preferable, the point that we'll come to again in a few minutes. We'll have to move a little quicker, just to say a few other ideas before we run out of time. So there's a fascinating idea in terms of she starts to have the children, she starts to name the son. So the first one is Reuven, and the pasuk says that she says Ki Ra Hashem Bani, that God saw what I'm going through, and now things will be better. So the interesting thing is, there's a Gemara in Maseches Brachos, which says a different explanation. The Gemara in the first parak of Brachos, on Dav Zayin, the Gemara says that the name Reuven, very complicated pshat, that Leah named her son Reuven because she said, Reuven, Re'e, Ma Ben Beni Leben Chami, the Ben Chami. See what's different between my son and my father-in-law's son. What is she talking about? She's saying that my father-in-law's son, Esav, so he willingly gave up the Bechor, and yet he ended up hating his brother because of it. While my son, Reuven, so he will unwillingly have the Bechor transferred to Yosef, and yet he'll still be the one who saves Yosef. He'll still be the one who's credited in the Parsha Vayeshev with being Yosef's hero. So you see, my son is so much better than Esav, than Ben-Chami, because he reacts to a similar situation in so much of a better way. So as the Pnei Yeshua notes, it seems to be a contradiction. The Torah says something else. The Torah says that this was her logic, Yirah Hashem Bani, and here the Gemara gives a different explanation. So a lot of the commentaries say that it's the same thing, that the Maharitz comments that basically what Leah was saying is, Yaakov will love me now. Why will he love me? Because not just because I have a baby, but because she'll see as I raise the baby that I'll do such a good job that he'll have such better midos than Esav, who he fought with, that he'll react so much better to Esav than Esav did in a comparable situation, that Yaakov will realize that I was always the one worthy of being the mother of the Shvatim, and he will have a greater appreciation for me. Or others point out along similar lines that she's invoking Esav's name here in order to make the point that she cried about the possibility of being married to Esav. In other words, she rejected Esav's values. That was Yaakov's whole point. So when Yaakov was reminded about how she rejected Esav's values, he'll come to appreciate her more, and that will also result in her being more appreciated. And the Uskarav, there's Naim Latari, points out also that this sounds like Miskabe B'Klon Chaveri, just bringing in somebody else's bad behavior in order to show off how much better you are. So again, it wasn't a random reference to Esav just to say, oh, Esav is bad and my son is good. But this was a part of her Hodah, that her whole issue was that she wanted to be saved from having to be the matriarch of Esav's family, so she's grateful to be the matriarch of Yaakov's family, and that that's a part of what went into this name. But I just saw an interesting thing with Halacha. I heard once in a shir from Rabbi Yisrael Reisman that he commented that sometimes you have a situation where a person, or somebody has a baby, and they want to name the baby, and the family is pressuring them to name the baby after someone in the family. And it happens to be that the parents of the new child, they're not so thrilled with his name. They don't have so much respect for this ancestor. They didn't want to choose that ancestor in order to name the child, but the family's pressuring them. So sometimes the advice that you give such parents, when they don't have another name that they prefer, they just don't necessarily respect as relative. So they tell the parents, okay, have in mind
a different person with the same name. Have in mind a different Esav, or have a different person with the same name, and that'll be who you're thinking of. But the family will be told that it's the relative they want, and they'll be happy, and you'll be happy. You'll have in mind a different person who you respect more. So Rabbi Reisman said, so they asked him, when he gives us advice, the parents say, but tell me, Rabbi, does that work? Whatever it means when I talk about the name, does that work? That you can have in mind one thing, and people will think it's somebody else, and they'll be happy, you'll be happy, does that work? So he said, there's a raya from here, that this is what the Gemara is saying, that what did Leah really have in mind when she was naming her son? She said that she had in mind that, look how my son is better than Esav, who is better than Esav. But she couldn't say that at the bris. She couldn't give a Dvar Torah like that at the bris and say that I'm showing off that my son's better than Esav. So at the bris, she said something simpler, Raj and Bani. So she told people one svara about the name, and really she had a different svara, she had a different person in mind, and this is a raya that it works. The simplest approach also is, God willing, you'll all have children, and you'll know that it's often the case that when you choose a name for a child, so there are a lot of things that converge to make you think of a certain name, and it'll very often be the case that you'll have a couple of reasons why you named a child with a certain name, so it's not really a contradiction. The Pasuk identifies one, and the Gemara identifies another. It doesn't really necessarily contradict. They could both be true, and that's you'll find that God willing to be the case when you name your own children. It happens more often than not. After that, we find that she names Levi. Although it's maybe not her name's Levi, the Pasuk says, Al-Kain Karosh Mo Levi. So Rashi says, doesn't say Tikra here, as he says by the other children. And he quotes the Medrash Agada that Gavriel was sent by Hashem and gave him this name and then gave him the 24 Matanas. He saw that this would be the ancestor of the Shevet HaKahuna who would receive all the Matanas. So the Emes Liakov, Rebekah Kamenetsky, is a comment over here that Yaakov saw that this was the case. He saw that Levi was the one to whom he would feel a certain connection because Yaakov was the progenitor of this nation of Ovdei Hashem, so if Levi was going to be unique in that way, so he felt a certain link to Levi in a way that the other children may be a little bit less so. So therefore, even if the other children, he let the mother give the name, so here he took on the role of giving the name, and that's why the Pasuk uses a different language. And he quotes this that this idea is based on the Pasuk in Sefer Bamidbar, Parakit Ches, where you find the form of the word Levi used in the context of how the Kohanim will serve, and that was perhaps what Yaakov had in mind, and then Leah saw that, and she gave the name as well for her reasons. So we'll just mention towards the end, there's a lot more to say, but we have to, we're out of time, but a very, very important and often cited idea is when Yehuda is born. So Yehuda is given the name Yehuda. So Leah says, for her fourth child, Hapam, Odes Hashem. Now I will thank God. And the concept of Hodah in the context of Yehuda, Hodah meaning thanks and Hodah meaning admitting, something we'll see in Parshas of Vayeshev, and it comes up in the Parshas Vayechi. It's a big theme, not for now, but just in terms of gratitude. And of course, this gets us back to our Hanukkah mentality. But the whole notion of Hodah, so the Gemara says over there in Brachos as well, that the Gemara says over there in Daf Zayin, that until Leah came along, there was never anybody who was Modeh to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Then Leah did, and she said, Hapam Odes Hashem. So it's an obvious question, because we certainly find that before Leah, the Avos and others did engage in thanking God for various things. So there must be something qualitatively different about the nature of the Hodah. So there are various suggestions to what it is. They're all worthwhile to contemplate. Rav Schwab writes that he thinks that the idea is that when she said things like Rosh, Ambani, etc., that the previous comments, they all included, this is good, but I need something else, I need something better. So in general, that's often the case. People are thankful for something, but they often have other emotions mixed in. And here she's willing to say, Hapam Odes Hashem, I'm just grateful for this, I'm not looking for anything else. Or as he points out as well, that there isn't even anything specific in the Hodah, just Hapam Odes Hashem, that maybe that's the type of Hodah that's being identified here. Many, the Torah Tamima and others, have a comment which you can find in many places, that that the idea is that when she, you know, which Rashi explains, you know, Chazal, the whole explanation there, the significance of the fourth child, was that she thought mathematically there's going to be 12 shvatim and 4 wives, so each one will have 3. So when she had her fourth son, so then she realized, okay, now I have more than I figured out I deserve, so Hapam Odes Hashem. So that mentality that
this is above and beyond what I deserve. That's really what Hodah is all about. That when Hodah is mixed in with the mentality, okay, I'm happy, but I really deserve this anyway. I knew this was coming all along. That's not a pure Hodah. But when one really feels that, okay, I thought that I was entitled to three, and now I have four, so the fourth one I realize is totally beyond the cheshbon. So that should really be the mentality about everything. So that's the idea of Hodah that perhaps Chazal is highlighting here. I will just mention one last point, that Paris Yosef quotes from the author of the Tiv Gittin, which I think is Rabbi Mishkarif, who's a great Talmud Chacham, who wrote many Svarim, but he wasn't able to publish them all in his lifetime. So he left in his Tzava that he'll pray in Shamayim on behalf of anyone who publishes his unpublished manuscripts. So recently that's been happening again. You occasionally see the Otzer of Rabbi Zilcharif, Rabbi Mishkarif, these farm kind of coming out. So I think it's that the author who's quoting here, that he says that the idea of Hodah as opposed to Shavach, that it's a difference between Shavach and Hodah, and that Shavach is praise for something good, but he says Hodah in this sense means that you thought something was bad and then you realized it was good. You realized that it was to your benefit. So this ties in to the idea we were mentioning a few psukim ago, that really she was not destined to have four children, five children, doesn't have any children, but because she was hated, so then it, or whatever that means, she was less preferred, so then it worked out that God gave her all these children. So that was, she began to recognize that that which was such a source of anguish to her, the fact that she was a snua, was all gamzul tov, but all resulted in tremendous bracha coming out of it. So that type of recognition, that that which you were originally upset about was actually the man hatov, that's a hodah in the purest sense, and that's what the Gemara is making reference to. And it's interesting because, again, we'll talk, maybe we'll have opportunities to talk in the future about how Yehuda is identified not only with this gratitude, but also with admitting, with acknowledging, and that we say also linguistically, as the Mefarshim point out, that there is a reason why we use the same word for admitting and thanking. It's the same idea that you acknowledge a debt to someone else, the same moda de mixtus, like we talked about last year, somebody who is moda to somebody else's claim. Thanking somebody and admitting are two interrelated ideas. So to hear, he's saying that hodah, in this type of thanking, it's a thanking specifically that's about acknowledging a change in thinking, that at first you thought this was bad, and now you admit that you were wrong, that this is actually something that was good. It's that type of acknowledgement kind of thanks that's identified as hodah here, and perhaps that's what the Gemara means when it says hapam oida es Hashem. Okay, I now acknowledge that it's time for us to have a mincha, so we'll stop now. We should have everyone a wonderful Shabbos.